The first case is 02-2241, State of Ohio versus Jonathan Monroe. Mr. Edwards.
May it please the court, Mr. Chief Justice, Justices, Counsel. At this time, I would like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Watch your time there.
Thank you very much. I know the court's well aware of the procedural history of this case and also the facts. From the briefs that were filed, and appellant's brief specifically, I would like to discuss three assignments of error, and obviously welcome questions on any other assignments that were raised. The first assignment of error that I would like to discuss, or proposition of law, deals with the trial phase of the case, specifically the ineffective assistance of trial counsel. The first portion of that argument centers upon the testimony of, at one time, Assistant Prosecutor Mr. DeVillers. And that is briefed in our brief under Proposition of Law 1. And to set the scenario of that, the state's key witness in this case was a person named Shannon Boyd, who apparently his street name, or he also went by the name Killer Bunny. And I think suffice to say, this was the key witness in the case. I would submit this is the reason why guilty verdicts on all counts were returned against Mr. Monroe, as well as the verdicts of death. During the cross-examination of Mr. Boyd, appellant's trial counsel tried to insinuate that there was some type of secret deal between Mr. Boyd and the prosecution. Apparently, Mr. Boyd was a co-conspirator in this matter. He entered a plea of guilty to 2 counts of involuntary manslaughter, received concurrent 5 to 25 year sentences under the old law.
And had that taken place prior to trial?
Yes, Your Honor, it had.
So that was all out?
I believe, Your Honor, that was all taken place before trial, the plea of Mr. Boyd, as well as the sentencing of Mr. Boyd, all taken place before trial. During his cross-examination, as I mentioned, there was apparently some questioning and there were some answers by Mr. Boyd that beside the agreement of the 5 to 25 year sentence, the reduction to involuntary manslaughter, that the prosecutor who handled that case, Mr. DeVillers, would write a letter to the parole board recommending a release at some point in time. Under the old law, I'm sure the court's aware that on a 5 to 25 year concurrent sentence, normally the person, in this case Mr. Boyd, would go before the parole board after serving 3.5 years. Because of defense counsel's persistent questions, the following day, the state of Ohio decided to call Mr. DeVillers as a witness in the case. We are not disputing that, or we are not saying that it's constitutional error or ineffective assistance of counsel that because Mr. DeVillers was not on the witness list or he should have been called as a rebuttal witness, that was raised by the defense during trial. I also want to make it very clear that we're not in any way here in this brief or this argument attacking the integrity of Mr. DeVillers in any way. Obviously a very fine person, outstanding prosecutor, now works as an assistant U.S. attorney. Our issue deals, however, with the redirect portion of Mr. DeVillers' testimony, when, in our opinion, he vouched for the credibility of Shannon Boyd. We believe that this was a direct violation of this court's many decisions, beginning with State versus Boston.
What were the exact words that he used? Because the prosecutors obviously answered your argument by saying he was simply responding to questions that you had posed, and that was not a vouching, or the defense
right.
counsel
posed. Exactly, Justice Stratton. And I actually pulled from the transcript what exactly Mr. DeVillers said. And I can just briefly, I'm not going to sit here and read for minutes, but on page 813 of the transcript, I believe it's volume 3, he was asked by the assistant prosecutor, question, why was there no gun specification on Shannon Boyd? And I'll just read the first sentence of his answer. The answer is, well, the bottom line is he was not the principal offender. And again, we would submit that's something for the jury to decide. It's not something for an assistant U.S. attorney and former county prosecutor to determine, to testify in a very matter-of-fact statement that Mr. Boyd was not the principal offender. The testimony becomes even more troubling when on page 814, I'm going to read the third or the fourth full paragraph of his answer, he's describing why plea deals are offered and why in this case. And he testifies as follows, and then we cut them a deal only after that, where we take that information and we evaluate it and say what it's worth, and we discuss if this person is someone who's telling us the truth, or we consider the evidence. And if we believe it, if it is true and we believe that it can help us in solving the crime, then what we will do then, we will do what is known as part two, and that is what's known as the deal part. Now, granted, we can see there was never a question posed, Mr. DeVillers, in your opinion, do you believe that Mr. Boyd was telling the truth? No, there was never that question asked. However, his answers are very specific, very matter of fact. And what's even more troubling is it's not just the assistant prosecutor saying, well, his statement corroborated the physical evidence. Because in this case, there was some physical evidence that apparently Mr. Boyd was able to offer the state, i.e., the ripped plastic glove. Mr. Boyd was able to testify that when he ran from the apartment down the stairs, he bumped into a door. So there were some things that he testified about that corroborated the physical evidence and the testimony of other witnesses. And I suspect that the prosecutor just said, well, he gave us a statement and it was consistent with the physical evidence, the testimony of the other witnesses, so this deal was offered. However, the prosecutor in this case went much, much further, as I state in my brief, where he said, we. And I think that's a very important word. It's not just his vouching for the credibility, but it's almost as if he's telling the jury that the credibility of this witness, that this debriefing process, that there's this layers where the police interview him, I interview him, he mentions earlier about Ron O'Brien, who's the assistant, the Franklin County prosecutor. And as a result, I think what we have in this situation is the state of Ohio, through a former assistant prosecutor, really stamping the approval and saying that this person is a truth teller. And again, that's something that in our opinion, that's something that really the jury should be deciding. I realize that the state, as I read their brief, and again, very well written, and it poses this issue of, well, didn't the defense open the door? Didn't the defense really kind of call this into question? And that's actually a very legitimate argument. But keep in mind, the first point I want to make is, I question whether or not the defense in a criminal case can open doors merely by asking questions, by making insinuations. I think we all can agree that one of the worst things that a trial attorney can do is to make arguments in opening argument or to make insinuations during cross-examination when you cannot support it with any evidence. I mean, to me, that not only does that harm the client, but it tremendously undermines your credibility before the jury. So the prosecutors really, in theory, didn't even have to call Mr. DeVillers, and they could have just argued in closing argument, well, look, trial counsel said this secret deal existed. There's no evidence of that. Mr. Boyd testified. Here's the plea agreement. But again, accepting the fact that he testified, this issue about the credibility of the witness, I mean, simply put, Mr. DeVillers should have only testified that there was no secret deal. There was nothing other than, here's your reduction to involuntary manslaughter, two counts. We'll recommend that those two counts run concurrent, and that I will then write a letter to the parole board at the appropriate time. And if he would have just testified to that, I think that would have closed any door. It would have, it would have satisfied the state's concern. So we're extremely troubled by this testimony. And what's even more troubling is that as it finishes up, on recross, defendant appellant's trial counsel then asks him a question, Mr. DeVillers, and you, meaning the prosecutor, and what law enforcement feels is good information, worthwhile information, with no indication as to what the jury may think, but this is good information or truthful information that you believe is that true. Now, why defense counsel would ask a trial prosecutor who's a great witness, who's obviously the jury may not know his reputation, but he comes across forthright and honest. very intelligent. Even Mr. DeVillers in this case realized, geez, I can't go that far. And his answer was, it's completely up to the jury. That's correct. So I think that even Mr. DeVillers realized, boy, I can't just come out here and say that, you know, I believe this witness to be truthful. So again,
Counsel, you're making a pretty effective, making a real effective argument as to why this was a bad tactic. And that may meet the first prong of Strickland, but the second prong is a pretty big hump for you.
That's always brought up, Your Honor. And I agree. Obviously, that first prong sometimes is a little bit easier to jump over than the second prong. And I think this court has always said, is it outcome determinative, is the phrase. And obviously, that's difficult because, you know, that takes into account a lot of hypothetical and speculation. I will say that Shannon Boyd, that this case, in our opinion, Mr. Barstow and I, we believe the case rises and falls with his credibility. Now, granted, there was a jailhouse informant, Mr. White, who testified. Granted, there was also a DNA at the door, so there was some other testimony. There were statements made by the defendant that refuted his view that he didn't know these folks. But as far as what actually happened in that apartment on Marion Place, what really happened there, whether or not Mr. Monroe was the principal offender, or whether or not he and Shannon Boyd, according to Shannon's testimony, just merely reversed places.
Well, don't the eyewitnesses who saw people leaving in a succession and the first one out before they hear gunshots, isn't that the most difficult part of the evidence in terms of suggesting that the state's principal witness was in fact the principal offender?
Your Honor, that's correct. That is difficult. I believe they're the Wises, and I forget their names, but yeah. They were, a husband and wife who lived downstairs. I think that the wife either she couldn't have identified Mr. Boyd because he wasn't in the courtroom, but I believe she picked Mr. Boyd out of a photo array and said that he was the taller, thinner man who bumped into her door, or at least she saw him run, and then she was hearing gunshots. As the defendant was then, she saw a second person who was, I believe she said, maybe she said he was taller, but much heavier. So obviously, again, Justice Pfeiffer, I agree that testimony is difficult to overcome. However, I still believe that when you have the key witness who puts the guns and the knives, the plan, everything into the defendant appellant's hands, and you know that he's the motive behind this. When you have a prosecutor vouching for his credibility, that is so unusual in cases like this. I mean, it's not unusual that you have plea agreements, but when you actually have a prosecutor stamping that approval, I just submit that raises, and it should create some doubt in the verdict. The second portion, if I could just move into the photographs, and again, I'm not going to spend as much time on that issue, but that is also part of our raising the ineffective assistance of counsel during the trial phase. You know, obviously, I concede that almost for 20 years since State versus Maurer was decided, this court has repeatedly held that, you know, gruesome photos. Obviously, I mean, if it's a capital case, you're going to have gruesome photos. I mean, that's not unusual. In this case, however, we believe that there are so many photos, not only crime scene photos, but also photos of the autopsy. Now, granted, as the state correctly noted in its brief, many of those photos for the autopsy were excluded, but there were many other photos included. And there were just a number of very graphic, just very just heinous-type photos of these two women in this unfortunate situation where they met their deaths. And the one point I would make is that this is not a case where in any way the defense was saying that this was not an execution-style killing. I mean, both women were bound, they were stabbed, they were the victims of gunshot wounds. This is not a situation where the defense was saying, well, this was an accidental death. They weren't disputing the nature of death. The dispute was solely who was the principal offender, who was involved. And I think at that point in time, and granted, I understand the state is allowed to try its case, it's allowed to present its evidence. There are obviously certain photographs that will help corroborate what the jailhouse informant said, what Shannon Boyd said, but it just seems that there comes a point in time when so many photographs, so many graphic photographs, there comes a point when just it's too many.
What was the total number of photographs admitted?
Judge,
a couple hundred?
I thought it was, Judge. I thought there were maybe 10 or 15. I believe it's M, N, and P. M were the autopsy photographs of Quincy. N were the autopsy photograph of Simmons. And then P were the crime scene photographs. And obviously, most of those photographs were the crime scene photographs. But I believe there were over 150, close to 200 photographs. And obviously the record speaks for itself, but for defense counsel not even to object, to allow these photographs to come
counsel,
in.
Counsel, it's my understanding that there were objections to the photographs, and the trial court judge eliminated photographs in chambers, or making a ruling, and then allowed, you know, close to, in excess of 100, probably shy of 200 photographs depicting the various injuries that were alleged by the prosecution. I mean, this was not just, as you said, an accidental shooting or a one shot to each victim. These women were bound, they were tortured, they were shot numerous times, they were placed throughout the apartment from one point to another. And it's my understanding that the trial court took that into consideration when determining the admissibility over the concerns of the defense counsel. So are you telling us that the defense counsel never raised an objection to the photographs?
Yes and no. And I'll try to clarify that, Justice O'Connor. It appears as if there was some discussion held regarding the autopsy photographs, which were State's Exhibit M, Exhibits M and N. So there was some discussion. It does appear that the court reviewed those exhibits and those photographs. And I think that there's even something where either defense counsel or the prosecutor states on the record that we've reviewed these with defense counsel. So it appears as if defense counsel did participate in objecting to some of the autopsy photographs. However, it does not appear as if there was any objection to the crime scene photographs. And again, I that part of the record, it's unfortunate because this is obviously a very important issue. That part of the record seemed to be somewhat confusing, but does not appear as if there was any objection. And I thought when I reread the state's brief that the state was at least accepting that portion of our argument, that there was no objection made by defense counsel of the crime scene photographs. Now, defense counsel did object during the mitigation phase, mm-hmm. when those photographs came in. Obviously, that was a proper objection. But again, we're troubled just by the sheer number, and especially those from the crime scene.
And didn't the trial court, though, take into consideration the redundancy and found that there were no photographs that, again, were redundant of the same injuries, and the cumulative impact of those photographs was eliminated because of each photograph depicting a specific injury or position or location that corroborated the state's case?
Your Honor, to a degree, I think that there was a review of the autopsy photographs. Now, my reading of the transcript, I am not sure. It was confusing in my reading as to whether or not there was a similar review of the crime scene photographs. It was my understanding, as I reviewed the transcript yesterday evening and even this morning, is that it was my belief, and again, I'm not trying to misrepresent anything to the court, that my belief is that the trial counsel for appellant did not register any objection to the crime scene photographs. I would like to finish up my time in talking about an issue that arose during the mitigation phase. And in the brief, it's been raised both as an ineffective assistance of counsel claim and also an error, plain error on behalf of the trial court. And this deals with the issue of defendant's waiver of mitigation. And I know that in the past 10 years, this court has had a number of cases where this court has discussed waiving mitigation, beginning with Wilfred Berry's case, through Mr. Ashworth's case, through Mr. Collins' case.
Did he really waive mitigation? He did give an unsworn statement, did he not?
He did give an unsworn statement, Your Honor. Yes, he did.
And there's a debate as to whom that was directed.
Exactly. And right.
And wasn't there at least one other witness?
Well, there was, Your Honor. And again, you're correct. There was a Ms. Dillard, who apparently was from defendant's hometown in West Virginia.
The question that I would have then is there's a tactical issue, and that would be how far can you go without opening up the prior murder conviction? So can you unwind that for us?
Sure.
I mean, because we're looking at it in the rearview mirror.
Right, exactly.
Could it be that counsel was concerned, defense counsel was concerned as to what they could do without opening that door for the prosecution? And perhaps they were wrong on how much they could do.
Right, exactly. And I realize, again, that, you know, one of the problems inherent in trying, you know, during the trial phase or during the mitigation phase is if you have some other incident like that, and I've had cases like that, and it's like that dark cloud that just covers everything that you're trying to do. And if I could just begin, Justice Pfeiffer, by saying I understand the syllabus in Ashworth where this court says that if a defendant waives the presentation of all mitigating evidence, and I realize that if this court, when it says all means all, then I realize that perhaps my argument becomes very difficult. What my argument here is that essentially Mr. Monroe waived mitigation. I mean, the opening statement in the mitigation phase by his counsel, I mean, it was, I think, 2.5 to 3 transcript pages. Ms. Dillard had not seen the defendant for over 20 years. I mean, she did shed some history. And what I think is very important from what she said was that it appeared as if defendant's grandfather, his mother, his father were all still alive. According to the colloquy between defense counsel and the court, the family members of Mr. Monroe were present in the courtroom. According to Ms. Dillard, there was a history of abuse, just abject poverty. She mentioned the difficulties of his mother, that she was very angry. I think she said that she'd have to feed him. So there was at least a stage set where it looks like that's just the type of mitigation that you want. You can present this defendant. Now, I know that the state raised this in its brief. Well, maybe this was all a tactic because of this murder conviction that the defendant was serving. And I would dispute that. Number one, it does not appear as if defendant's counsel said, well, we're not going to call these people because we're afraid it may open the door. It was pretty clear that the reason why these folks weren't called was because the defendant was making a conscious decision not to allow his family members to testify. And that's troubling because there was not one question from the trial court to the defendant. I mean, do you, under the theory of Ashworth or under the theory of Collins, and the Chief Justice's dissent in Collins, there was no questioning of the defendant whatsoever. It's, look, do you understand that, you know, that the aggravating circumstances have already been proven? There are 8 counts of aggravated murder against you. There are 4 specifications to each count. If, you know, you understand that the jury's going to do this weighing, you understand that the family members can talk about your background, and that's under the catch-all, could be used as mitigation. There was no discussion, Justice Pfeiffer, at all about any of that. Now, I submit that you can conduct a very effective mitigation, and it may be a delicate balance, it may be tiptoeing through the raindrops a bit, but the family members don't have to comment on the previous conviction. They don't have to say anything. I think it would open the door if the family member said to the jury, well, spare his life, he would never do something like this. I think that would open the door. But if all the jury member, or if all the family members were doing was talking about his background, his upbringing, the fact that he was abused, the fact that they grew up in poverty, the fact that they didn't have enough food, they didn't have enough clothes, the father and mother didn't work.
If they said he was always a good boy and never got in trouble, that probably opens the door.
That might open the door. That and again, I realize this is a very delicate situation, but most mitigations are delicate. I mean, you know, rarely does defense counsel have that person who is a new member of the court system. I mean, normally you have people who have been around, they have previous convictions, they have histories. But again, the family testimony, especially about this kind of background, very rural, poverty-filled West Virginia in the hills, I think this is something that would have been very powerful mitigation, and it could have been presented. And I realize to some degree, I mean, the state's correct. There's some speculation here, but there's surely no speculation. It's very clear that there was no questioning of the defendant. There was no questioning of Mr. Monroe as to whether or not he understood what he was doing. And I think similar to Collins, although quite not as strong, where Mr. Collins obviously was very disruptive, and I think he was yelling and screaming, he wanted to fire defense counsel, and the judge was taking him out of the courtroom. At least here, we have a little bit where it appears as if there is a rift developing between Mr. Monroe and his defense counsel. In his unsworn statement, he makes a comment about, well, I didn't really get a fair trial here. My defense counsel didn't do this, they didn't do that, which again, you know, when you look at his defense counsel, you know, it looks like for the most part, they fought very hard for him. I mean, they called the witnesses, they recalled 2 of the state's witnesses. So it appears as if perhaps Mr. Monroe, or at least there's some evidence on the record, that he perhaps was not understanding what counsel was doing.
So you would have the trial judge here. This puts the trial judge in a difficult situation, does it not? Where the defendant himself says, I don't want to offer my family members to come and speak for me to the jury. That the trial judge here should have questioned the defendant. That's your contention? Question the defendant understood, to make sure he understood what he was giving up, possibly giving up. Maybe we don't know what they would have testified to, but is that?
I think so, Your Honor, yes. I think that's correct. I think it would be similar to a defendant perhaps waiving his right to a jury trial in a capital case, you know, entering a plea and then proceeding to mitigation, that type of colloquy, or perhaps a defendant in another felony case waiving his right to counsel and wanting to try the case himself. You know, some type of, like under Feretta versus California, some type
well,
of...
Well, counsel, if he would have totally rejected a mitigation phase or the presentation of evidence, but here we don't have that. We have a limited amount of mitigation. We have an unsworn statement. We have no representations by trial counsel to the court that they're troubled by their client's decision not to bring in family members and testify. He had, you know, an acquaintance or a friend of the family from 20 years ago, and he has his unsworn statement as evidence for the jury's consideration in the mitigation phase. So what you're saying is you're trying to put this trial judge in, I think, a very uncomfortable position, and I don't know whether legally, you know, there's any criteria given what the trial judge experienced in the courtroom, which was a mitigation phase. Because he didn't parade a whole host of family members before the court, you're asking us to make a ruling that a trial judge has to evaluate the quality of mitigation evidence and inquire into the competency or the understanding because it may not meet the quality of mitigation that another defendant may have put on?
Mr. Chief Justice, my time is up.
You're sure you can answer the question.
I'll just respond very briefly. Justice O'Connor, I understand your concerns, I understand the syllabus in Ashworth. My concern is I think there comes a point in time when the mitigation is so fraught with a lack of mitigation. I mean, the unsworn statement was no mitigation whatsoever. I think, in fact, the first sentence, Mr. Monroe says, you know, this isn't to you, this isn't to the jury, this is to my family. And that's my concern, is you know, we're not asking that the proceedings be adjourned and you bring a psychologist into the courtroom and have him evaluate, but it seems like there should be some type of questioning of the defendant, especially when the trial court knows.
Mr. Edwards, is that the duty of the trial court judge, or is that the duty of defense counsel to do that? You seem to push this on the trial judge, and the trial strategy should be with defense counsel. Do you want us to shift that?
No, I don't want to shift. In fact, I think that's why we try to raise it both ways, both as ineffective assistance of counsel. I frankly feel
our role is to write a rule of law that will apply to all the rest of these cases. What is the rule that you would want to see written for the state of Ohio in this connection?
I would ask this court to extend the principles espoused in Ashworth and Collins, that if a trial judge is aware that a defendant is knowingly or is waiving mitigation, that the trial judge should question that defendant to determine whether or not that waiver is a knowing, intelligent, and voluntary waiver, and that the defendant understands what could result so that it satisfies the tenets of Lockett.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Edwards. Mr. Taylor.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court. Just a few housekeeping items. We filed a supplemental authority a few days ago, and we've cited the Jordan case, which discusses Ashworth. Jordan was decided in 2004. The Yarbrough case, which was decided some years before, that discusses what the merger analysis is for aggravating circumstances. And I think the defense is raising a merger issue under the 12th proposition of law. In the ninth proposition of law, there was an issue at the time we filed our brief regarding whether or not a third verdict form went back to the jury. And we dropped a footnote and said we're going to file a motion to correct the record because we had indications in the court's written instructions that in fact the trial court had submitted the third verdict form. And there were three verdict forms per each count in the penalty phase. And in fact, the trial court granted that motion to correct the record and confirmed that the third verdict form was read to the jury in the oral instructions and was sent back with the jury. And so I wanted to make sure the court was aware of that, that there is a supplemental record filed regarding that, regarding the ninth proposition of law. I guess I'll start with the Boston issue in the first proposition of law and the ineffective trial counsel claim that's raised regarding Boston. I think in this case we pulled our punches a little bit, and I think we could have done more than what we actually did. Now, I think there's a difference between indirect evidence that someone believes another witness and direct evidence that is prohibited by Boston. And I cite the Stowers case. And Boston itself also talks about how let's say a clinical psychologist can talk about how the psychologist concluded from X, Y, and Z, including the child, including the interview of the child, that that child abuse did occur. And I think there's a difference between direct expression of opinion on the veracity of another witness and indirect, and I think we have indirect here. And so I don't think there's a violation of the Boston principle. But I think there's a clear opening of the door here that allowed the prosecution to get into this issue of what the plea bargain provided regarding what the prosecution required as far as truthfulness. The defense, in its opening statement, went beyond just saying there was some secret term of the plea agreement. They said that the Columbus Police Department and the prosecutor's office, in effect, and here's the quote, the defense said in opening statement, information was manufactured and it was handed to somebody so he could spoon feed it back. In effect, the defense was accusing the prosecution and the police department of suborning perjury by feeding information to Shannon Boyd and trying to have Shannon Boyd convict the defendant.
Well, this argument is advanced under an ineffective assistance of counsel prong or theory. And what you've just read would seem to bolster that argument, bold-faced and unsupportable statements were made by defense counsel in opening statement undermined the credibility of the lawyer and therefore of the defendant.
Well, I think you see actually that they tried even after ex-prosecutor DeVillers' testimony in the cross-examination of the detective. They tried to develop this line that the police were feeding information to Boyd. So they were still pursuing that avenue, and they tried to pursue it, and they no doubt thought at the time of opening statement that they would be able to make that argument in closing argument. I think the prosecutors in this case had to take the defense at their word. They were going to try to prove that the prosecution and the police were basically suborning perjury by feeding information to the witness. And so
How do you handle in Franklin County disclosure to defense counsel? They just get the bare minimum allowed under the rule, or do you have an open file process in Franklin County?
We do not have an open file process.
You do not have?
In particular cases, the individual prosecutor sometimes does provide open file, but I don't know whether that was done here or not.
You could see how that would help. Defense counsel would not go jumping into this pond if they were able to see the file and see exactly what did happen.
Well, and I think the point of your questioning, Justice, is whether or not it was reasonable for them to open this door. And I think in my brief, I point out why it was reasonable, and that's because they really had nothing else to argue. You see a discussion in the transcript about how the defense counsel said, we filed this notice of alibi, but we really don't have any evidence to support it. It's all vague and nonspecific, so we don't want witnesses to lie. So the alibi was not there. You've got the strong DNA evidence of the bloody DNA from the defendant on the front door of the crime scene. And they had no explanation for how his DNA got there. So they didn't have anything else to argue,
Is defense counsel able to know ahead of time that these eyewitness neighbors are going to be able to say on the stand that your key witness was out the door before the gunshots?
Well, I think
would that basic information be available to defense counsel in preparing for trial?
I'm sure their names were provided in discovery. Whether or not they interviewed the witnesses or whether or not they knew that, I'm not sure that's clear from the record.
I guess I'm driving to a larger point because it still concerns me that prosecutors rejected this court's initiative to have an open file process or some prosecutors did. Some prosecutors provide an open file, but in terms of search for the truth and search for justice, you would avoid some of these quagmires. And I don't know the defense lawyer here, but I mean, he's the defense of this case is being made to appear, and it does appear to be a pretty inept job. And it's the second prong of Strickland that saves the day for you, isn't it?
Well, I think the second prong of Strickland is a strong argument for us, given all the evidence talked about.
It would seem that the defense here on appeal has made a pretty compelling argument for the fact that counsel was ineffective.
No, I disagree with that, Your Honor, because what else could they have done in this case? They had no evidence. They had no alibi. They had no explanation for the bloody DNA on the door.
Well, but you don't normally set up traps for yourself and for your client. I mean, what else you could do is keep your mouth shut altogether.
Well, and he still would have been convicted if that were the case. I mean, they were trying to do something. They had gotten discovery in the form of the videotapes of the interviews of Shannon Boyd, apparently, because that's what they were basing this manufactured claim on. And in cross-examination of the detective, they tried to back it up. I don't think they backed it up. But in any event, they launched the allegation that the prosecution and the police were basically suborning perjury. And so we have this Boston issue. What could the state put in response to that? And I've cited a couple of Court of Appeals decisions which have applied the open the door analysis to Boston issues. And I've cited State versus Camel, which is a case, a decision out of this court in the mid-1980s, in which
the DNA evidence is that the strongest thing? Because the neighbors, they see two people wearing of different sizes and shapes, wearing different garments of clothing, but not a real strong ID to put the defendant there. So is it the DNA that just nails him without your key witness?
The DNA is, I think, the strongest piece of evidence. But the second strongest, I think, is both of these witnesses, the neighbors, describe the different sizes of
right.
the two people who fled. And that goes a long way towards corroborating Shannon Boyd's testimony.
Well, counsel, don't you also have the statements to the jailhouse witness?
Correct. I'm
where
going to get to that too.
The testimony, I mean, the defendant, describing what transpired in the apartment. And, you know, I'm looking at the questioning or the concerns about the open file discovery or lack of open file discovery. No matter what the form of discovery offered to defense counsel, there is this age-old tactic of trying to discredit a plea-bargained witness. I mean, it just goes with the territory, and you know, in the attempt to establish reasonable doubt with the jury as to the credibility of the witness. So, as I said, that's an age-old tactic. I'm at a loss to determine how that can be classified as ineffective assistance of counsel.
Well, I agree. It's an age-old tactic, and here they took it to the nth degree to try to do something in the case to save the defendant, and they had no other theory to argue, so they attacked Shannon Boyd. They attacked the jailhouse informant. They attacked the prosecutors and the police. They had nothing else to argue in this case, so in considering reasonableness, and I think I cite the Massaro case in my general discussion of ineffective counsel claims. They talk about how, as a general matter, ineffective trial counsel claims are unreviewable and really can't be decided fully on a direct appeal because of exactly these kinds of issues. It may appear unusual or unorthodox that the trial counsel pursued one strategy, but Massaro talks about how the alternatives may have been even worse. And choosing between doing nothing and sitting there like a potted plant, or doing something and at least trying, I mean, I think there's a reasonable choice between those tactics. And so There's also the notion in this Boston issue under the first proposition of law is whether or not the defense could welcome this testimony about how the prosecutor vets witnesses and defendants in plea agreements. This court's cases, the Cornwell case, Williams case, and the Jackson case, which I've cited in my brief, these cases talk about how truthful testimony terms in plea agreements are a double-edged sword because it gives the defense an argument that, well, maybe it's not the truth, maybe it's the witness trying to please the prosecutor. And so a reasonable trial counsel could sit there thinking, well, this isn't so bad that this is coming out. We can argue that this shows even more that the prosecutor is trying, that the witness is trying to curry favor with the prosecutor. In any event, I think it would have been proper, given this opening of the door, that the prosecutor could have been asked directly, what caused you to enter this plea agreement? What entered into your belief that he was providing truthful information? And I think we could have gone further. We pulled our punches, and to that extent, I guess we avoided more issues on direct appeal. But in any event, I think that we could have gone further. And so I don't think it was incompetent for the defense to open the door. I don't think it was incompetent for them not to object having opened the door. They didn't really have a valid Boston objection.
Counsel,
at that point.
It's my understanding that Boyd was pled and sentenced before offering testimony.
That's my understanding, too.
Which is a little unusual. Isn't it usually, at least my experience as a prosecutor, is that the sentencing took place after trial, so that the witness would follow through with truthful testimony. There was nothing to hang over this defendant's head at that point.
Well, there was the term that provided that the prosecution would write a letter to the parole board informing them of what that Shannon Boyd had cooperated. So I guess that was something, a carrot, that would allow the prosecution and prevent Shannon Boyd from changing his mind, I guess, mm-hmm. As far as testifying. So there was still that. But I've seen it done both ways. Sometimes the sentencing is done before. Oftentimes it's done afterwards. So I think as far as the first proposition of law, the defense counsel were not incompetent in the sense that they opened the door. They didn't have much choice to do anything but do that. And that once they opened the door, they didn't have a valid Boston objection to make. Also, there's this notion based on the Cornwell case and other cases that a reasonable defense counsel could welcome that testimony as fodder to argue that the witness was trying to curry favor with the prosecution. And then finally, as some of the questions have talked about, no reasonable probability of different outcome. What other outcome would the jury have come to in this case? The witness himself said it's credibility is up to the jury. And we have this information about truthful testimony, truthful information, possibly being a wash because, as this court says, double-edged sword. We've also got the strong evidence of guilt. We've got the DNA. We've got the defendant's confession to the jailhouse informant. We've got the two eyewitnesses, one of whom identifies Shannon Boyd as the first witness, even while gunshots are still being heard upstairs. That evidence clearly places the gun in the defendant's hand, and the both wises said.
Counsel, on the DNA question, there was the discussion of a mixture of DNA. So after this case is presented, the DNA and the cross-examination, that it was strong evidence. It wasn't scientific evidence that was subject to some question.
Well, I think the defense did try to conduct its own testing, and by that time, I think the sample had been used up, and there was an issue raised in the trial court on that, which they're not raising on appeal. But I think it was strong evidence, and I think regarding this particular sample on the front door, I don't think there was any mixture as far as I recall. There was testing of knives, blood found on some of the knives, and there was a mixed pattern in regards to that. but I don't recall any mixed pattern as far as on the front door.
Could you address the photographs, just the sheer number?
This number of hundreds and hundreds just vastly overestimates the issue.
Well, what
in this
is
case.
The number?
There were over 200 crime scene photographs, but the vast majority of those do not even show the victims. They show the crime scene in other respects. Some of the crime scene photographs show the victims, but they aren't gruesome. They don't show blood or anything. For example, the defense argues in their brief that there's photographs of Trevenna Simmons' feet being bound. They've been bound by tape. Those photographs are not gruesome at all. They don't show any blood. There's nothing gruesome about those photographs. Now, there are gruesome photographs in the case, but I would submit that they all survived the review that this court has set forth in the Maurer case.
How many photographs did the court disallow?
Well, and the record's not completely clear on this, Your Honor, but my understanding is that it reviewed the morgue photographs, and it disallowed six for one of the victims and I think nine for the other, and that accounts for the gaps in the numbering of the exhibits that were eventually submitted. As far as the crime scene photographs, I don't think those were reviewed. I don't think there was an objection that preserved that issue. There was a general motion in limine before trial, but that was just general, and there was no specific objection to the crime scene photographs, and those were published to the jury during the trial phase without objection. So we got the plain error issue regarding those two.
So Mr. Edwards is correct when he said that his understanding of the record is that there was no objection.
To the crime scene photographs, that's correct. And there was this review, and it's not clear
how
who prompted
happened.
The review, but there was a review by the trial judge.
In chambers.
It's discussed at the end of the trial phase. There was a review of the morgue photographs. Now, even then, I think we've got a waiver issue in the sense that the trial court makes its ruling and excludes some photographs, keeps some others, and we still have no objection to the remainder that were admitted into evidence. And I think a motion in limine ruling like that, you still have to get into court, and when they're offered into evidence, you need to object to preserve the issue. And that was not done. So we've got a plain error analysis regarding that,
as too. As to the final issue that was raised, your understanding, had family members been called and just talked about the conflicted and difficult childhood, would the prosecution have not been able to raise the murder conviction if that's all the family members testified to?
Well, I think that's one of the issues. We don't know what the family members would have said, because we don't have anything in the record to say what they would have said. And we've cited the Keith case, which talks about, well, you can't really decide what these non-called witnesses would have said, because that would require affidavits, and you can't do that on direct appeal. But in any event, I think that you can see a few times in the transcript where the defense was concerned about opening the door to that 1998 murder conviction. And I think once you put the witnesses on the stand, you kind of lose control a little bit over what they say, number one. But number two.
So your view would be it was a tactic and a proper tactic?
It very well could have been a tactic. We don't know for sure what was going on. What the defense told the court is that the defendant does not want these witnesses called. And what this court has clearly said is that it is not ineffective assistance to follow the client's desires as far as not calling witnesses in the mitigation phase. This court has said so in Tyler, Collins, Ashworth, and that doesn't raise issues of competency. And as this court's questioning of Mr. Edwards raises, Ashworth does not apply unless you're waiving all mitigation. And here they did not waive all mitigation. So there was no need for an Ashworth colloquy with the defendant regarding whether his knowing and voluntary intelligent nature of his decision.
Given what happened and what didn't happen, is there any room on appeal for us to conclude independently that mitigation outweighed the aggravating circumstances?
I think the aggravation is overwhelming here. We've got two people killed, and the aggravated murders come in that weighing process, two purposeful killings in a course of conduct, and we've got these four, you've got these three other felony murder act circumstances, including the kidnapping, which was extended, extreme restraints, hostage-like restraints, extended, prolonged restraints, and I think
isn't that where the application of Strickland, second prong, becomes difficult? Because failing, I mean, you would argue even calling everybody that you could wouldn't trump the aggravating circumstances. But failing to put those witnesses on just absolutely slams the door for overturning the imposition of death on appeal, does it not?
Well,
And if it does, doesn't that come close to meeting the second prong of Strickland?
Well, I don't think so, Your Honor, because that begs the question of what these witnesses would have said. We don't know. If it would have been more of the same as to what their witness said, what Dillard said, it's a mixed bag. You know, they talk about the poor upbringing, the deprived upbringing is what Dillard talked about, but she also talked about how they attended church and there was some, the defendant was not completely deprived of an upbringing, I guess. And when you look at the, compare this case to other cases, that this court's reviewed where the background is truly extreme and pathetic, vast, extended child abuse of the defendant, and this court has not hesitated to affirm death sentences in those cases. But we don't know what these witnesses would have said, number one, but number two, if you assume that it would have been like what Dillard said, then it's a mixed bag, and I don't think it changes anything regarding
legal. Yeah, on the legal issue, why should we not take Mr. Edwards' suggestion and write a rule that requires a trial court in a situation such as this to be certain that the defendant knows what he or she is giving up or knows possible consequences of not offering more mitigation evidence than was offered here?
Well, I think I've got a couple of responses to that. Number one, we'd be in plain error review, standard of review on that, and I don't think this court could reverse on that basis. I mean, Ashworth only says that a colloquy is required when all mitigation is weighed. And if this court set forth a new rule in this case, I think under the Barnes analysis, you can't reverse on plain error when you're basically changing the law in that case. But number two, I think it'd be very intrusive to get into those kinds of things. You would be intruding into the tactical decision making of the defense. Now, the defense here said, we're not calling these witnesses because the defendant doesn't want us called. But there could have been many other reasons why the defense did not want them called. And I pointed out, for example, some of these same witnesses were the so-called alibi witnesses, who they decided not to present because they didn't want them to lie. So. There could have been issues as far as that goes, and it just would have been very intrusive for the trial court to get into that. And so unless they're waiving all mitigation, unless there's that clear demarcation where the defendant's basically giving up in the mitigation phase, once you start questioning, well, you're not calling this witness, why aren't you doing that, it would just be too difficult to administer and too intrusive into the attorney-client privilege and other matters that may be going into that decision. I think I'll otherwise stand on my brief unless the court has any further questions.
I had one procedural question with regard to the photographs. Were they presented through the testimony of a single witness? the question of the crime scene photos, for example. Did defense counsel have an opportunity to object before they were admitted? Was it done en masse, as it often is, before the close of the plaintiff's case, or were they admitted serially through one witness?
My I did not read the crime scene detective's testimony in preparation for this, Your Honor, but my recollection is that the crime scene photographs were presented through the testimony of the crime scene detective, and they were published gradually as his testimony went along, and there was no objection. And finally, at the end, in Franklin County, we do this kind of en masse admission of exhibits at the very end of the case in chief. And so it was done at the end then, too, and there was no objection then. But some of the exhibits were published to the jury before that, during the crime scene detective's testimony. There being no further questions, I would ask that the court affirm the convictions and the death sentence. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Taylor. Mr. Edwards. You've used your time, but you may take 30 seconds.
How much time do I have, Your Honor?
30 seconds.
30 seconds. I'll be fast then.
Unless you can get someone to ask you a question, then you have more time.
Okay, thanks. Just very quickly, Justice O'Connor, to respond to your comment, I want for myself to be clear on that issue. We're not questioning counsel's effectiveness because he attacked the plea agreement. I agree. That's a standard procedure. What we're adding is what Justice Pfeiffer mentioned. Counsel here laid a trap for himself. He made comments to disparage the state and to the police. He opened a door, and then he failed to object when Mr. DeVillers testified. My only last comment would be that I do not believe that it would be overly intrusive to extend Ashworth and Cowens in this case. You would not have to ask the defendant why you're not choosing to call witnesses or defense counsel. You would not be asking for strategy, but you would merely be asking, do you understand that by not calling witnesses, do you understand that by not presenting mitigation that you have could result in a death verdict? Thank you.
Thank you. If the case is submitted, you'll be advised of our opinion.